I really am grateful to be here and to be a part of what I feel is some very important thinking that's going on. As I said, the titles were given to me, and I love them. The title, On Thy Care Depend, which is our focus for this morning, I like taking that passage in its fuller context. Because, as you know, the beginning of that sentence starts out, and it really gives us, I think, the key to this whole business of care. O Lord, I would delight in thee, and on thy care depend. That's the contingency. We delight in our God. We delight in our relationship with our God. We delight in the word of our God, which feeds and sustains us, and always accomplishes that for which it was sent forth, which never fails to accomplish its mission. We delight in our way-shower, Christ Jesus, and what he has taught us about God's wonderful, loving, never-failing care. When we delight in what we understand about God, and delight in what that understanding teaches us about man, then we inevitably have that wonderful assurance that enables us to depend always on his care. Whenever we look at the issue of caretaking, especially as we're doing in this conference, we're looking at benevolence, we're looking at giving and caring, and we're looking at the issue of meeting every human need. The need not only for ourselves, but the need of our brother. We find in the teachings of Christ Jesus and of Mary Baker Eddy wonderful fountains of care, that is, meeting the human need. We have, for example, Jesus' commandment that we love our neighbor as ourselves. And we have, in his discussion, his powerful story that he told in answer to the question, who is my neighbor? And you all know that story. The Good Samaritan story certainly illustrates the caring for our brother in a really, truly magnificent way and serves as an inspiration for us regarding the teachings of brotherly love. There are so many gems of inspiration from the Bible. We can't look at them all, but I'd like us to consider together just a few of them in their spiritual significance. One from Mark. For he that hath, to him shall be given, and to he that hath not, from him shall be taken away even that which he hath. Now, I think this is one of the harder teachings of Christ Jesus, and in my early experience, at a time when I was a single parent providing for three small children, and I was eligible for welfare, I didn't pursue that, but I was eligible. And I was trying to make my demonstration in Christian Science as a new Christian Scientist, and this Bible verse was very troublesome to me because it seemed so unfair. Every cell of my being wanted to say, it's not fair. What kind of a God of love is it that could give to him who already has all he needs and take away from him who has not? But that's a literal interpretation of the Bible, and Christian Science teaches us to go beyond the literal interpretation. And as I began to learn to read the Bible in a more metaphysical way, I began to understand the spiritual import of those teachings, which have been so foundational to me in overcoming that poverty condition. Of course, the Bible verse means, to him that hath understanding, it shall be given, and to him that hath not understanding, he won't even be able to keep what he has. To them that understand that divine love meets every human need, they will experience and demonstrate that divine love meeting of the need. How is this done, and what is the measure? Well, the measure that we find all throughout the Bible, God's measure, is the measure of abundance. We find it all throughout, in the manna. Always, not just a meager, just enough to get by pouring out, but all they needed, and then some. We find it in the widow's cruse of oil, abundant measure. We find it in both instances of Jesus feeding the multitudes, more than enough and left over. We find it in the promise from Malachi, bring ye all the tithes into the storehouse, that there be meat in mine house, and prove me now herewith, saith the Lord of hosts, if I will not open you the windows of heaven and pour you out a blessing, that there shall not be room enough to receive it. Now that God's measure of provision, always an abundance, a fullness, a pressed down and running over measure. But because we are metaphysicians, and especially in this age of outrageous materiality, it's important that we really understand what supply is. The world wants us to believe that it's all tied into numbers. Numbers of dollars that we count as our riches or our lack. We count our money, we plan, we save, and we worry over those numbers. But if we look to Mrs. Eddy's discussion of supply, especially in that little gem entitled Angel, she says, God gives you his spiritual ideas, and they in turn give you daily supply. It is never more money that is needed. That's just more numbers. All we ever need is God's idea. What does the Bible tell us about angels? That there are legions of angels ministering unto us. A legion, by definition, is a great host or a multitude, and the suggested number is 3,000 to 6,000. So again, when God provides his angel messages, it's an abundance of right ideas. When we understand that supply is always coming to us in the form of right ideas, we can begin to understand how Mrs. Eddy could write with such confidence, giving does not impoverish the giver. Because great ideas can be given away and we still have them. Look at these two contrasting terms, money and supply. They're often used interchangeably. But they should no more be used interchangeably than the words matter and substance. We know that matter is the counterfeit, the unreal, the temporal, the illusion. Matter appears to be the stuff out of which the universe is made. But we know that's the illusion. Spiritual substance is the stuff out of which the real universe is made. That is, right ideas. Because the universe is exclusively mental. Now, a similar contrast exists between the concepts of money and supply. Money, as matter is the counterfeit. It's that which appears to be real and necessary to our well-being. The erroneous, the temporal, that which is capable of being exhausted. The counterfeit, or spiritual right idea, is supply, an idea, not a thing. We can run out of things. We can have not enough things, but we can never run out of right ideas, and that's the real stuff which constitutes supply. If we unwittingly accept money as the standard of provision, we have accepted a matter measurement. Money is like matter, and can be measured and limited. As soon as we accept money as equating with supply, we have done what I like to refer to as buying into the numbers game. And it's really a game we don't want to play. As soon as we think we need money for anything, we're playing the money, the numbers game. Now again, let's continue this discussion of the concept of money and matter as contrasted to supply and substance. It's easier for us to understand when we're thinking of matter, because we know we don't even cherish healthy matter. We know that healthy matter is as unreal as sick matter. And likewise, we need to be careful that we don't get fooled into thinking that a big bank account gives us more substance or supply than a small bank account. Bear with me and think this through. The numbers in a bank account, in a checkbook, in an investment portfolio never tell us anything about the real man. We have to be alert because the numbers game is so seductive. As we watch our own world economy, as we think in terms of our own country's indebtedness, as we think in terms of the high interest or low interest, I think it's so interesting. We all love to buy our homes and our cars with low interest rate, but oh, how it hurts when we see that same low interest rate applied to our certificates of deposit or our investments or our IRAs. And that's the numbers game. You get into it and you get caught. It's such a seduction to be watching the numbers. As long as we do that, we're not working out the problem of supply in Christian Science. Supply has nothing to do with numbers. It has everything to do with right ideas. Over the years in the public practice, I've seen demonstrated repeatedly Mrs. Eddy's promise, giving does not impoverish us in the service of our Maker. In fact, the very act of giving is often that which breaks the mesmerism of lack and opens our thought in a way that we can receive the good in God's measure, abundance, the good that's always already there as the outpouring of God's magnificent, all-encompassing love. We see that when an individual holds in his thought the belief of lack, when he has accepted the mesmeric suggestion, I don't have enough, he then finds himself fearful because our experience is the inevitable manifestation of our thinking. Our acceptance of the suggestions of lack put us in this no-win situation. If we believe we're lacking mortals, then we'll continue to experience the lack as long as we believe it. But if we refuse to accept the suggestion of lack, regardless of the material picture, and insist upon the spiritual fact of our abundance, we can demonstrate our sufficiency, as Paul so clearly saw when he wrote, referring to God, "My grace is sufficient for thee." This sufficiency is our understanding of the outpouring of mind's qualities, ever present, always available, and always in abundant measure. I knew a young mother who demonstrated this in a beautiful way. Her husband had left her, and she was alone caring for her three small children. The courts had ordered him to pay a certain amount of support, which was rarely forthcoming. Through her understanding of Christian Science and a lot of hard work, she was able, in a meager sense, to meet the demands of each day. In time, she remarried, and shortly thereafter, her new husband was unemployed. She now found herself in the position not only of having to care for herself and her three small children, but also of her new husband. He was a Christian Scientist and worked hard at whatever odd jobs he could find, as he kept sending out resumes and pursuing his job search. Over a year went by, and he was still unemployed. And they depleted every resource they had, borrowing to the hilt, and now it looked as if their only recourse was to sell their home. Every week she looked for that support check that her first husband had promised to give her to fulfill his legal and moral responsibility as a father. And every week her disappointment and her bitterness grew. Her first husband lived in another state, and her attorney had tried unsuccessfully many times to have him address his accumulating indebtedness in his responsibility. Her prayers were earnest as she kept examining her own thinking and accepting the responsibility of making the demonstration, knowing that it is as important to see through the suggestion of lack as it is to see through the suggestion of lack of health or lack of integrity or any other so-called lack. Through her attorney's effort, her husband finally promised to send a small lump sum. And it would have been a real godsend, she felt, because she felt so desperate in their need. But the days and weeks went by, and it was obvious that his promise was not going to be fulfilled. Finally, one day, she realized, as a result of her prayers, how mesmeric her dependence was on this support check. Occasionally, when a small amount would come, it would just get him over a hump, and she would feel, oh, it's coming now, and we'll be all right. there would be promises of more, but then again would return the disappointment, the hurt, the bitterness, the accusation, the judgment, the resentment. Every kind of negative thought would roll around in her consciousness and underscore her belief in lack. Many times her husband, her new husband, in his job searches, would find that he would be strongly considered by the personnel department as one of the last two or three contestants, only to find the disappointment when someone else was chosen. But one day it came to her that she had to take a stand for God's supply. On thy care depend, as the hymn says today. Not on the care of her new husband, not on the care of the father of the children, not on the care of her own work, but on God's care alone. And it came to her that it would be wholesome for her to release her first husband from his legal obligation. She realized he would still be responsible in his own sense morally, but she wanted to check out of the numbers game, where she would be weakly, anxiously hoping and awaiting the check, however small. So she called her attorney. He did everything in his power to try to dissuade her from this decision, reminding her that it was his legal and moral responsibility. But she assured the attorney she wasn't trying to relieve him of his responsibility, but that would have to be between him and God, not between him and her or him and the court. She opened a bank account in the children's name where he could voluntarily contribute whatever he wanted to, whenever he wanted to, for the children. And it would be used only for them. But she got out of that mental mesmerism by being convinced that God was going to be the provision for her and the family. Before the letter was even sent to her husband, first husband, while the attorney was still drafting the letter, out of the most unusual set of circumstances, which would be a whole talk in itself, her new husband quickly found himself in a wonderful job, a job which was everything he could have hoped for in a field that was his greatest interest. He started out immediately at a good salary, and because he was so ideally suited for the job, within 6 months, his salary had been increased over 25%, and within a couple of years, his salary had doubled from his starting salary. And he continued in that. I wish we could tie it up in a little neat package and say the father of the children then immediately started sending support checks. That never happened, but it was no longer any of her concern. That was his responsibility. The whole belief of lack was met through that one courageous act of refusing to continue in a thought pattern that kept affirming lack. Getting all the way out of that numbers game, getting into the kind of thinking that affirmed supply, that affirmed God's care and provision. In my own experience, many times when I've been generous in my benevolence, when I've seen another's need and looked away from my own wants and needs to give generously, within a short time I have found an outpouring from unexpected places, more than filling in whatever hole there seemed to be. The very act of giving is the affirmation of I have. The act of withholding is an affirmation of I have not. And we will experience what we affirm. That's why giving always blesses us. That's why our benevolence and our generosity always come back to us, the bread cast on the waters, coming back fourfold, sixfold, tenfold. It's inevitable because it is an affirmation of I have. There's a wonderful testimony in the October 1964 Christian Science Journal. I was a new practitioner at the time, and this was one of the first times that a journal had a theme, and it was all on the practice. First two testimonies were by practitioners. Second one was by Geith Flimmer, and I don't know the name of the, I didn't have a chance to look up the name of this woman who was a practitioner in England, but she told of her experience in her demonstration of supply as a new practitioner. She entered into the public practice at a time of considerable sustained rises in the cost of living, which presented greater expenditures than she had planned. And she experienced a sense of financial depletion that was frightening. In her testimony, she said, these are her words, I knew that all supply, being spiritual, had nothing to do with a bank balance. I recall having read in one of our periodicals a statement to the effect that any expenditure that one made to learn more of Christian Science in order to help mankind was true investment. She continues, I thereupon decided that there was no greater investment in the world than that of establishing the Christian Science practice in a needy community. I made no curtailments. I endeavored to maintain the living standards befitting a Christian Science practitioner. I continued to maintain subscriptions to all the periodicals and contributions to the church and the field. I began to see every payment as an investment, even to take more interest in the outgoings than in the incomings, and found it an exhilarating and inspiring. I kept my money circulating all the time, not allowing a day to pass with an outstanding debt if I could avoid it. I was uplifted and I rejoiced. The deadline came at the turn of the year when the bank manager sent me the half-yearly statement showing a balance of 3 pence. 3 on the side of principal with all debts paid. This could have been the straw that broke the camel's back, but it was not. Knowing that the carnal mind had nothing to give a spiritual idea, I just laughed aloud. Then I started to throw into the balance of principal gratitude for all the dividends already received in Christian Science and gratitude for every proof of the healing power until I realized how rich I was and what an affluent father-mother I had. The mesmerism was broken. The testimony would not be complete without grateful acknowledgement of the way the windows of heaven opened and poured out their treasure from innumerable sources so much and so quickly that I was tempted to say, not so fast. Isn't that beautiful? I just planted myself on that my first several years of being in the practice. There's so much fear circulating in human thought today regarding this number game. The inflation numbers, the interest numbers, numbers regarding the economy. We hear them over and over, and when unemployment or depleted funds hit close to home, the numbers can even be scary. But if we go back to this wonderful hymn, 224, the first verse promises, when all material streams are dried, thy fullness is the same. And there again we see that wonderful example of God's measure, fullness, abundance. It goes on to say, may I with this be glorified, satisfied, and glory in thy name. If or when the material streams are dried, as our dear practitioner got down to 3 pence, God's provision comes forth abundantly to each of his ideas by way of reflection. And the very extremity of one's experience gives us the opportunity to witness God's abundant outpouring of good. We're all familiar with Mrs. Eddy's example of reflection. When you stand in front of the mirror, if the original's hands are full, the reflection's hands cannot be empty. And I love the hymn From Glory Unto Glory in its discussion of abundance. The fullness of his blessing encompasseth our way. The fullness of his promise crowns every dawning day. The fullness of his glory is shining from above, while more and more we learn to know the fullness of his love. That's the only measurement there is in God's economy. What does all this have to do with benevolence? I think it's pretty hard for anyone to break the mesmerism of selfishness and reach out to his brother when he sincerely fears he doesn't have enough for himself. When we think in terms of giving, we have to first recognize we already have all we need, and then it's easy to give. The scientific understanding that God supplies our every human need is the basis on which we can obey Mrs. Eddy's statement, the rich in spirit help the poor in one grand brotherhood, all having the same principle or father, and blessed is that man who seeth his brother's need and supplieth it, seeking his own in another's good. The assurance that comes from the prodigal story, Son, thou art ever with me, and all that I have is thine. is our basis for demonstration. When we understand this, we will never fear that giving will somehow deplete our resources, because our resources are not material. They are not those things that can be counted in numbers. We give of our hearts, rich overflow, not out of a bank account. We do this in a way that humanly meets the need, our brother's need, and we will be willing to supply it from our hearts, rich overflow. The teachings are there. Inasmuch as ye have done this unto the least of these, ye have done it unto me. Give, and it shall be given to you, pressed down and running over. And Mrs. Eddy tells us, with additional joys, benevolence should be more diffusive. As we delight in our God, depend on Him, as we understand that God's reflection always has what the original has, and that God is ever with us and all that He has is ours, when we refuse to play the numbers game, understanding the fullness of His blessing and His glory, all fear about sharing and caring and giving shall be removed. We know that every time we give unto one of the least of these, it affirms our own unlimited, abundant measure of supply. And with every affirmation comes more. And then we see that all good, where'er it may be found, its source doth find in thee. And I'm going to close with another verse from that hymn. He that has made my heaven secure will here all good provide. While Christ is rich, can I be poor? What can I want beside? O God, I cast my care on thee. I triumph and adore. Henceforth my great concern shall be to love and praise thee more. O God, I cast my care on thee, and on thy care depend.